So thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. When I took on this particular topic, I was asked to speak on the subject of truth in the academy, truth in the university system, which some of you may think is kind of oxymoronic at the moment. We live in an age when one can Photoshop their child onto a member of the rowing team and be admitted with $500,000 into an elite university. So I'm not so sure what that tells us about the state of truth in the academy, other than it's pretty bad. I do want to talk about what I would argue are some diagnostic observations of what exists in higher ed today. And briefly summarized, I'd even go so far as to say that the intellectual sphere, as represented by our university system, by academia, and by the products of that sphere, are entering into what risks becoming a stage of epistemic crisis, a stage in which truth is discounted and completely subordinated to a variety of political objectives and other social objectives that are associated with it. And to support kind of this argument, I would put forth three general observations or trends, although in some sense they're really symptoms of what I think is going on in the universities today. The first of those is an empirical claim that I can actually provide you with some data on, and that is within the past 15 years, American university systems have undergone an unprecedented ideological shift toward the left. And this is measurable. Now, you may be saying university professors, they've always kind of been on the political left, which is absolutely true. We have data going back to the 1960s that showed consistently a plurality of professors self-identified as members of the political left, and that would be defined as everything from, say, a New Dealer liberal to a far-left Marxist, and everything in between. But from about 1960 to the late 1990s, there was actually a stable minority of other, conservative, moderate, libertarian, the whole range. And that hovered in the neighborhood of about 30% of faculty self-identified as conservative, and then the gap in between was the fluctuating moderation. The trend that we've seen since 2000, by continuous repetition of the survey, the most recent one just came out a few weeks ago, is the liberal left percentage of the academy self-identification has shifted from a consistent place in the low 40s, 41 to 42%. To today, it hovers consistently around 63, 64% of faculty self-identify on the political left. And that's all pronounced. That's within 15 years of time that shift has occurred. We could talk about some of the implications of that, and one of them has to do very strongly with the state of intellectual discourse and exposure to ideas that come from outside of that paradigm, but I do consider it an alarming trend. We can put some raw numbers as well to it. And those raw numbers are actually pretty discouraging. I've done over the past several years my best attempt at trying to measure the number of professors that operate in what we could call broadly the humane disciplines: economics, philosophy, history, law, political science, areas that deal with issues of relevance to society, social trends more broadly, to try and get an accurate measure of how many academics in that realm would fall or self-identify on the fusionist right. So everything from conservative to libertarian, pretty much the representation of what we find here in the society. And we hover probably around 10,000 professors nationwide as a very rough estimate. It does fluctuate a little bit, and if you expand it over into mathematics and business and accounting, yes, those numbers would increase. But talking about those core humane disciplines, about 10,000 professors. Give you some perspective, according to the last survey of it, there were 36,000 professors in the United States that self-identified as Marxists. So I'd say we're in pretty small minority shape compared to where even what we would consider the fringe of the far left operates in the academy. Second observation I'd make, and this connects to a theme that Jay Brennan and I tease out in our book at length, and this deals with how the academy self-diagnoses its own problems. Those problems, as we've seen in the admission scandal and many other similar events, the grievance study hoaxes that afflicted the Academy a few months ago, a succession of similar problems. But it could be everything as simple as the student loan crisis that's ongoing. There's a general recognition that academia has some severe underlying problems that tend to operate in pervasive ways and far-reaching ways for the quality of the product that's being delivered. But the answer, the self-diagnosis of those problems, has shifted away from empirics, has shifted away from truth, has shifted away from a dispassionate analysis of evidence, and instead embraced what I would call a theory of poltergeist. Now, what is a poltergeist? It's an invisible creature that inhabits the room and goes around and throws paper and furniture around, makes a giant mess of things, and then departs. But poltergeists don't exist. I'll give you some examples of the poltergeist. If you read the academic self-diagnostic literature or even the daily pages of the Chronicle of Higher Education, the number one problem diagnosis that exists for everything that we see in the academy, and this comes from the admission scandals all the way back going years to budgetary crises, almost anything and everything is attributed to this one problem. The academy has supposedly been captured by neoliberalism. I'll ask you, is anyone in this room a neoliberal? And you can use that ironically. There are some attempts to appropriate the term back, which is entirely fair. But we find there are very, very few people in this world who would self-identify as neoliberal as, in any other route than that attempt at ironic self-appropriation. Yet neoliberals have supposedly taken over the academy, and they've subjected it to another poltergeist, and that is called the corporatization of higher education. Whenever I hear this term, I'm reminded of the old movie, the classic Team America World Police, where one of the actors is brought before the camera and he says, the corporations in their corporation building are being all corporation-y because they profit. And that's essentially the argument that's put forth as the reason why problems exist in the academy. Poltergeist explanations are abundant. We see them offered everywhere for diagnosis of very real problems that I would argue could be better understood as simple responses of human beings to incentives, to trends, to institutional structures in the academy. And yet, rather than to attempt to understand those structures, rather than attempt to understand what might motivate an admissions officer to take a bribe or a professor to overinvest in a program with declining enrollment or an administrator to allocate vast amounts of tuition-raised money to building a lazy river or a rock-climbing wall on campus, both very real examples. It's actually attributed instead to the mystical creature, the poltergeist, that's moved in and taken over the academy. I think this is actually symptomatic of a broader problem, and that is a rise of almost conspiratorial thinking as a diagnostic tool in how we deal with observed real-world problems and also imagined problems that are stacked on top of those real-world problems. Third observation, closely associated to this, and I think symptomatic of both of the first two, is a measurable decline in rigor in the academic sciences. And that decline can be seen through multiple symptomatic displays in recent years. The grievance study hoaxes that swept the academy a few months ago, in which a group of three scholars submitted basically fabricated papers on fashionable political nonsense to journals in the humanities and found, I think, 7 out of 15 or so of them are accepted and printed in what are ostensibly academic outlets, including top outlets in certain subfields. The grievance studies hoaxes range the gamut from replicating and altering the text of Mein Kampf to pass off as feminist sexuality theory. The other example, one attempted to diagnose rape culture in dog parks. But it's just a litany of absurdity that certainly appealed to the political biases and the fashionabilities of certain sectors of the academy. But I would argue that the political dimension of this is only the sideshow of what's really going on here. The political dimension is a very bad symptom of some of the effects of the decline of rigor, but that decline itself is not so much about bias, but what it really shows about the state of scholarship. The real story of the grievance study hoaxes is not that they found fashionable ideas on the far left and exploited them, although that played a part of their strategy. The real study there, or the real problem that we can diagnose from that there, is that a group of three non-experts, non-scholars in these supposed areas of high intellectual discourse, over the course of about 6 months, were able to convincingly fabricate and replicate studies, journal articles that would be sufficient to be accepted at some of the top outlets in these subfields, and if offered in a serious package, would make a formidable CV to present for a hiring opportunity or even tenure in some universities. In other words, they faked the field. What does that tell us about the quality of the field and the real stuff that's published in those same fields? It's actually often indistinguishable from the hoaxes, or as I would often say, impossible to parody. What does this mean for the state of truth in the academy? Three quick observations. First, the hyper-politicization of the faculty, which I do think we see in the rapid shift toward the left, is not necessarily a problem in the sense that the political left itself brings a message, as much as we may disagree with it, they do bring a message to the table that should absolutely be part of the conversation. But what is happening in that shift is a movement away from plurality and towards basically intellectual hegemons that are emerging of a single voice, a single outlet, a single echo chamber of knowledge production. Now, if you ask anyone in that that sector of the academy, they'll adamantly deny that this pattern is even occurring, and in some senses, very sincerely so. Knowledge production does occur within an overall left paradigm, often in very diverse ways internally, but this is the type of intellectual diversity that basically takes 17 different various schismatic versions of Marxism and asserts that if we allow them to debate each other, we've got diversity. It's an interesting thing. Marxism itself is a realm of thought, both in its own products and offshoots, probably has more schisms in it than the first 1,000 years of Christianity all summarized. But what we get is kind of a people's Judean front versus people's front of Judea type scenario of people that agree on 95% of all issues that are debated, fighting over the remaining 5%. That echo chamber is not conducive to the production of knowledge because it represents and portends a breakdown in some of the internal check mechanisms that intellectual competition brings to the table. And in fact, it is closely related to the rise of paranoia, the rise of the poltergeist as an explanation for any and all problems that are encountered. Interestingly, what comes out of a study of paranoia that's taken part and taken captive hold over large segments of the academy is a diagnosis that would much more closely be associated with the figure on the left. That's Richard Hofstadter, the famous progressive historian, who in the 1960s diagnosed paranoiacs as a major feature of the American political scene. He was talking at the time about McCarthyists, some of the fringe of the John Birch Society, mostly members of the right. But Hofstadter was intellectually honest enough to note that paranoia is not distinctive of ideology. It's in fact something that afflicts all regions of the political spectrum and sphere. But I'll briefly quote from Hofstadter. His diagnosis of the paranoiac is someone who does not see social conflict as something to be mediated or compromised. It is a conflict between absolute good and evil. Since the enemy is thought of as being totally evil and unappeasable, he must be eliminated. And eliminated, if not from the world, at least from the theater in which the paranoid directs his attention. And I'd argue we see ample evidence of that, a diagnosis of neoliberalism, corporatization as an affliction of the academy, followed by an urge to purge both of these evil poltergeists from the academy. A metaphorical exorcism, if you will have, of what's going on. This is manifested in what I would argue is an increasing tabooification of previously normal, previously open areas of discussion. Tabooification in the sense that certain topics of research discussion, certain methods of analysis are written as off-limits in academic circles. And we're not talking about Nazism, racism, other deplorable ideologies that rightly belong in the dustbin of history. Although strangely, that never seems to extend to Soviet communism in many of these same circles. But rather, an attempt to categorize something as common and simple and widely utilized and understood and studied as the economic analysis of markets itself, as being inherently tainted by colonialism, by racism, by other taboo subjects, and therefore worthy of expunging from the academy. We see this in multiple recent episodes, not only the grievance study hoax, one that I've been an observer and combatant in, the recent episode over Democracy in Chains by Nancy MacLean, a major widely awarded book that came out 2 years ago that's essentially an attempt to cast the entire public choice tradition of economics, free market economics, as an offshoot of 1950s segregationism. The book itself is largely based on fabrication, has been widely debunked. Myself and Mike Munger have both been participants in that debunking, yet at the same time was elevated to multiple book awards, a nominee for the National Book Award, has basically gone unchallenged in the academy. And this gets to my final observation of what the decline in rigor has done to academia. As rigor has fallen, as standards have fallen, and as fashionable nonsense for political aims have become elevated as the main component of the discourse, we've also seen a decline in correction mechanisms, historical correction mechanisms, to deal with problems ranging from subpar to outright fraudulent work. Historically, this was served by peer review. Historically, this was served by ethical standards that were set up by professional societies in the academy, internal self-policing in departments to hold their own members to standards of rigor, standards of basic scholarship. As that collapses, as that further declines, we actually find an inversion of those mechanisms wherein organizations that previously existed to self-police now become institutions of offering and showering awards and acclaim upon persons that violate what we would consider quite justifiably the basics of scholarly norms of truth. Is this pervasive? Not yet, fortunately. Is it existent? I would say absolutely. And we see evidence of it emerging on multiple levels. I'm going to close, though, by drawing upon an insight that comes from James Buchanan himself, the great economist who was the target of Democracy in Chains. And he posed a question, seeing similar symptoms emerging in the academy himself in the late 1960s, early 1970s, as its own crisis of rigor, its own crisis of epistemic basis. And he posed the question, says that as a society, if we are going to exist in ways that operate and devote substantial taxpayer resources to the funding and support of higher education, part of the return that a taxpayer has a legitimate right to expect is that the standards of education adhere to the pursuit of some level of truth, adhere to some offering of benefit to society. And I would argue that as truth declines, as it falls in the academy and other institutions that were historically seen as its caretakers, that obligation or that interest in public investment itself starts to decline. Buchanan's observation was that the faculty operating on the other end of this question operate in such a way that they expect the taxpayers to toss bags of money over a wall and not pay attention to anything that's going on the other side of that wall. If we don't police for truth, if we don't adhere to standards and indicate that we expect those standards to be followed and advanced as a core part of our intellectual dialogue, then we as taxpayers no longer have that obligation to toss money in the direction of persons that are abusing it. I'll close on that, and I hope we can return to this in the Q&A.